Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall.
And I'm Joe Keating.
So this episode came about as part of my trip around Northwest America in June, where I got the opportunity to stop by and talk to Professor William Stein at the New York State Museum in Albany.
And what was it you got to talk about?
Well, in 2010, he and his colleagues published a paper which made the front cover of Nature. It was on some new work done on the oldest fossilised forests in the world at Gilboa in New York.
Okay, so we're talking about the Devonian.
Yeah, that's right. Anyway, we discussed the history of the research in Gilboa before going on to the paleoecology of the forest and its significance. So let's just dive into the interview. The significance of evolutionary events can only be measured by their impact on other organisms and their environment. However, few are so significant that they can physically change the entire planet. One such example of this radical change is the origin of terrestrial forests. Here to discuss one of the earliest forests known in the fossil record is Dr. William Stein, whose paper on the paleoecology of the first forests of the Devonian was recently published in Nature. First, could you give us a little introduction about yourself and the work that you've done?
Well, I must say first that the paper was actually a joint enterprise with the State Museum, the New York State Museum, and also Chris Berry at University of Cardiff in Wales. So it was a joint paper with several authors, not just me. I'm a Devonian paleobotanist and been very interested in studying the origin of plant form and morphology. In recent several years, I've gotten very interested in the origin of paleoecological systems with plants as the dominant player, as they always are in ecosystems.
So that's how the...
And I'm here in New York State, and it's just been a great opportunity when the people at the State Museum call and say, we've got something we look at. I'm always here to take a look. And we've developed quite a close relationship with Linda Hernick and Frank Mantellini, who are part of this research team. So I'm up here a lot. I'm in the process now of transferring the Binghamton University collections up here, so as a permanent repository for them. So we're very, very busy with all kinds of interactions.
So this Devonian forest that you have here in Gilboa, could you tell us a little about the locality, where it is and how old it is?
The Gilboa locality is... in the village of Gilboa, which no longer exists.
Interesting story about that.
but in the late 1800s, there was a thriving village in the Schoharie Valley, along the Schoharie Creek. That site was a place where constantly people were finding interesting fossils of various kinds, in particular fossil plant pieces of something that was actually quite large, sort of like that. As of about the 1880s, there was a major flood in the area, subsequently called a freshet, which is the term I had to learn when I came to New York City.
Freshet.
A freshet. this uncovered very large tree stumps at a site right at where the old bridge was at the village. In the 1920s, the city of New York needed to expand its water supply, and they built the Schoharie Dam directly below the site of the village. The village no longer exists. It's actually
underwater.
of the Schoharie Reservoir.
Do you know if it still exists?
The village
underwater?
The village was actually depopulated and actually torn down to the level of the basements of these things. So it's been gone for many years, although the villagers, the people who live in the Gilboa region, are very, very proud of their area. And so the people of Gilboa and the village of Gilboa may not exist, but the people in the area of Gilboa have long history going back several generations. And they remember very, very clearly those events, as they keep telling me. Mm-hmm. So at any rate, the 1920s, as part of constructing the Schoharie Dam, they had to they wanted to face the dam with large sandstone blocks of the area. So they opened a quarry about a quarter of a mile just downstream from that called the Riverside Quarry, which they meticulously hand-sculpted blocks of about 3 foot by 3 foot by 3 foot blocks. Took them with a little steam engine up to the side of the dam and lifted them in place. And as part of that that quarrying operation, they began to discover large numbers of standing upright trees looking like big onions almost. So big bulbous bases with a flat bottom and invariably broken about 3 feet or less toward the top in all kinds of different shapes, but all quite large.
Did they realize they were trees when they just had this onion shape?
I think they recognized that they were clearly large enough to be, they were probably plants large enough to be trees. They had no idea what they were. They called the State Museum in the 1920s. Winifred Goldring was a paleobotanist at the State Museum who then oversaw a collection of many of these forms. There's an interesting story associated with that collection, which I'll tell you about in a minute. And she was responsible for identifying what they were and providing them a name. That name is Eospermatopterus. That was her name for it. Now, the interesting story was that to get them up there, the people that were doing the quarrying, and especially the engineers that were associated with the quarrying operations for the city of New York, were also very, very interested in these artifacts. These are very interesting fossils. And this site was really very, very famous. We don't quite know who was responsible for what kind of decision-making back then, but the result of this is a large collection of these were actually transported by the old roads that they had up to Albany from the site, and they now sit here at the State Museum, the largest collection of these things. However, if you go practically anywhere in the world in a major museum, you will find one or more of these specimens someplace. Because they were widely touted at the time, thanks to Winifred Goldring, as being the evidence of the earliest forest on Earth. So that idea being that the oldest forest has been a long-standing and very, very attractive sort of theme that's associated with this Riverside Gilboa site. They had problems when they got they're bringing their stumps to Albany. They were actually handed on an old-fashioned Model T or Model A truck. The whole truck ran to the Brankaveen Bridge and actually went through the bridge.
And so ended up in the old village of Gilboa.
Famous picture, which I'd be glad to give you a copy of something that was labeled by the State Museum as paleontological difficulties in collecting.
So this Eospermatopterus, could you tell us a little bit about this plant, this tree, what it looked like and how it differs to the kind of trees that you get today? Or if it is indeed related to the trees we got.
For many years, nobody had any idea what Eospermatopterus was, although a lot of hypotheses had been put out in terms of how to interpret it relative to modern plants. The major ideas were that they were an early seed plant. That was Winifred Goldring's idea. Other possibilities that they were large arborescent, that is, tree form lycopsids, which are the major scale trees of the Carboniferous coal swamps, which is a great, very well-known kind of early tree, which would make it a non-seed-bearing plant of very great antiquity. There are other suggestions that they might be related to early ferns, one type or another, but ferns are hard to understand. They show up in the Carboniferous in groups that we began to recognize, but in the Devonian, many things are fern-like in terms of the reproduction, but we don't know if they're necessarily all that closely related to ferns. They're much, much more primitive plants. In 2007, we proposed a connection to the top of the Eospermatopterus tree stumps, which are basically sandstone casts that are always broken.
So those are the onions.
Those are the onion pieces. Yep. With material we collected nearby, approximately 10 to 13 kilometers away, a place called South Mountain in the Catskills of New York, in which we found two very interesting specimens. One was a complete crown of a group called the Cladozylopsida. It's a class-level group, and I'll talk about this in a second. But unfortunately, there is no modern name or no other way to describe this except using the Latin group. And then we also found, in addition to the crown, we also found an extensive amount of main trunk of a plant that was clearly overlapped what we could see at one end with the crown on the one hand, and also overlapped the base of one of these Eospermatopterus trees on the other hand. The Eospermatopterus trees are always preserved at Gilboa upright, and they're filled in with sand. They're probably hollow. The one at South Mountain was preserved laterally. It was preserved sideways and crushed, so we had a different view of it. That allowed us to actually make the connection. So now the Cladocyclopsida are a group of very early, very large, probably very large early trees, and based on size, that's about all you can. That would be the definition of tree. Eospermatopterus is by far the most conspicuous member of those, but they run back well into the late Lower Devonian period. Some material we found in the Gaspé of Canada, and it's a worldwide thing. They're well known in Europe.
So is that earlier than Gilboa?
All of those sites are actually earlier than Gilboa, but nothing near as large yet.
Ah, right. So the importance of Gilboa is the actual number.
So the recognition that Eospermatopterus was a member of the Cladocyclopsida allowed us to say, okay, this group really does take off very early in the history of terrestrial ecosystems. They become the dominant elements probably at least in the old red continent, that is North America and Europe, as the earliest kinds of trees, of which Eospermatopterus is by far the most conspicuous.
When were the first plants, when did they make it up onto land?
Plants first made it on land probably in the, well, there's a big debate about that. Certainly the evidence becomes pretty clear by the late Silurian that we have very interesting little plants to middle-sized plants. In the Lower Devonian, they reach perhaps diameters of a centimeter or two and as much as, I would say, 3 or 4 feet high. It's hard to say. By the late part of the Lower Devonian, the earliest part of the Middle Devonian, we begin to pick up the classic Middle Devonian flora, which consists of Cladocyclopsids, so we know that they're on their way. And even in Gaspé, we have things that are several centimeters in diameter that are beginning to show clear evidence. Germany is another place where they've been found recently as being reasonably good-sized plants, and one can quibble about how big do you have to be a tree, but they're well on their way becoming modern-scale kinds of forests, as opposed to earlier forms, which might have been quite a bit smaller-scale forests, so tabletop kinds of heights. Now, you asked about the Cladocyclopsids. Cladocyclopsids are a cheiridophyte group. They're a group that actually bears sporangia, like you see in a fern, and not seeds.
So those are the little spores?
The sacs that actually bear the spores, that's the term used, cheiridophyte, meaning a plant that bears those kinds of things. In modern forms, of course, those are seen in very few things. Ferns are the major group, but also some fern allies, like the lycopsids, like the scale trees, scale plants, also horsetails, acrocetophytes, and a few other really obscure things. However, in the Paleozoic, they were the dominant elements of all forests, all floras. When you're talking about Devonian forests, you're talking about very early plants, and they're all cheiridophytes. They predate the origin of seed plants, which happens at the end of the Devonian.
So we've really not got to think about forests as we know them now, with pine cones and seeds, but it's all reproducing using spores.
They're all reproducing using spores, and we have modern analogs that are very, very few and far between to compare these early kinds of plants with. Another analogy I like to draw with Cladocyclopsids is that nobody asks somebody about a dinosaur as being some kind of bird necessarily, although clearly there are relationships. Dinosaurs are interesting because of their size and their importance at the time that they existed. Same is true with the Cladocyclopsids. These were the big plants of the era. They might be related to modern ferns, but that tells you almost nothing. Just like if you were to say that dinosaurs are proto-birds, that doesn't tell you a whole lot about the ecology of dinosaurs on the one hand, or how they differ from those of modern birds on the other hand. So, Cladocyclopsids are commonly sort of viewed as being the ancestors to either the horsetails or the ferns, but in fact they were what they were.
So was it just that one kind of tree that was present, or were there other forms?
At the Gilboa site, we had the opportunity to actually observe the actual forest paleosol. That's the term we use for the ancient forest soil, in which the trees were still rooted, and that came as a big surprise. We never expected that that site was still, based on the descriptions, we never expected that site existed after a few years. The quarry had been filled in, and we had no access to it for nearly 90 years.
So once it had been uncovered in the storm, they covered it back over?
As part of reconstructing the dam in the last couple of years, we were invited actually as paleontological consultants by the City of New York to actually oversee the paleontological resources of that site as they removed the old quarry material and did the work that they had to do, and then their intent, and they've actually carried out that intent to actually cover it back over with materials.
So that was just for you?
We had a short period of time because they needed access to that site to be able to use and crush the stones in the site for work that they're doing at the quarry site itself. So we have had wonderful access, but the critical period of time for seeing the paleosol turned out to be a relatively short period of time, a couple of weeks, in which what became apparent to us was that the ancient forest was still preserved as no longer as the standing sandstone casts that had been removed in the 1920s, but as the footprints of the casts still in place, showing the position of the trees in that forest. So with a lot of help from the city, the Department of Environmental Protection of the City of New York, and also the contractors at the site, they allowed us to excavate or clean off a portion of that paleosol, and we mapped it. And what we found at that site was dominance of the Eosmerontopterus trees. There were roughly about 100 individual trees or tree footprints that we could find.
All in life position.
All in life position, showing the roots still attached, showing the position differences in size, occasional twins, one that fell over, all kinds of interesting sort of details as you might expect to see in an ancient forest. The thing that came as a big surprise, however, was that there were two other major players at the site besides Eosmerontopterus. There's a group which, again, because these are ancient plants and there are no modern analogs, are hard to use except anything except their Latin name. The Aneurophytales is the group that we found there. This group is very interesting because originally Goldring in the 1920s thought that foliage material that she had found in and around the Gilboa region might belong on the Eosmerontopterus trees, and she reconstructed it that way. That fell apart very early on when it was recognized, especially by German paleobotanists, that this group was a different kind, the Aneurophytales. A long history, and have been very, very well studied both in Europe and North America and other places, and that reconstruction was, wouldn't work. It doesn't match the evidence.
Okay, so you had your.
But what was interesting was that what we found was that the Aneurophytales are present at that site as an understory plant of large size. That was the second major player.
Okay, so I'm just getting the picture of the Eosmerontopterus. Nowadays, we recognize it as this jigsaw of pieces. You have the onion base, you have the long stem, and then you found the top of it.
The crown.
But back at the start, when we were just understanding these trees, the Aneurophytales was the one that they put as the crown. But now you recognize it in this locality as being a completely different plant.
It's a different plant. It's very much more fern-like in some respects. It has a ground-running rhizome or horizontal main stem. Attached to it are many roots, but only in some places. Other places it appears to have no roots at all. It's meters in length and as much as 15 centimeters in diameter. So it's tree-sized, but it's not growing upright necessarily as a tree.
It can grow horizontally.
It's growing horizontally, perhaps crawling into the canopy of the Eosmerontopterus trees. We're not quite sure. The fact that it doesn't have roots everywhere suggests that parts of it are ascendant, which is the term we use for things that are up off the ground somehow.
Okay. So it had roots all along its stem.
It had roots along its stem in portions where it was in contact with the soil. In other places, it's running into the canopy with producing new branches all the time and continuing to grow up into the canopy as a semi-horizontal to perhaps semi-upright, clearly tree-sized player in this ancient forest. But perhaps depending upon the Eospermatopterous trees for much of their support, very much perhaps like a vine. We have to be kind of careful because modern vines have lots of other features that we typically associate with that kind of morphology from the modern. But this may be the first evidence we have of something approaching that kind of life habit, if you will, in an early forest. So these two players that originally been put on one plant by, this is Winifred Mulvey again, are clearly strongly associated with each other in this ancient forest, but they're different players. The other thing that's really interesting about the Aneurophytales is they're the first group in the fossil record to actually show evidence of wood. They're woody plants. The woody plants, along with the seed plants, comprise a large monophyletic group that is a group that can be traced to a common ancestor. That group is sometimes called the lignophytes because they actually have wood, mm-hmm. the first woody plants. And Aneurophytales are the earliest evidence we have in the fossil record, both in North America and in Europe and other places, of woody plants. So here we have the first ancestral form to what would become trees later in time, at least by Carboniferous, if not late Devonian in time. But they're not the major player in this forest, so they're subdominant to the Eospermatopterous.
What's the relative abundances of them? Do you get as many Aneurophytales as the Eospermatopterous?
Because they were running around the ground, on the ground, and in and under and on the surface, we have partial evidence of many, many stems. We've probably found 30, 40 stems. Some of them might, in fact, have been continuations of other parts that we've also found at the site. So they clearly are not as numerous as, in terms of what we can measure as Eospermatopterous, but a major player.
Okay, so the preservations of them, you say that they are upright and sandstone casts. Now, when we think of fossils, we normally think of everything as having died. But if they're upright, were they preserved when they were actually still alive, all in life position?
That is a great question. We've been really worried about that a lot. It's how do you get these an entire forest of upright trees that have been decapitated at approximately the same level? That level corresponds to the thickness of the sandstone horizon that actually entombed the forest.
Okay.
There's a large sandstone block. It's probably deposited as a single kind of event, lasting on the order of hours to a couple of days, but not years or eons.
How thick is this?
The sandstone unit is approximately a meter thick.
A meter thick. So in a few hours to a day, a meter of sandstone ended up swamping this forest.
Right, and probably, in our guess, killing it.
Yeah, I don't suppose so.
Preserving it in place and perhaps decapitating whatever was actually bearing all that sand as the water that's actually depositing that sand presumably tore the forest apart.
So it's a fluvial sand, so there was some big kind of flood again.
The Schoharie Valley is right at the boundary, the fluctuating margin between the fluvial system of the Catskill Delta Complex, it's called, which is a huge set of rivers that were draining off of the ancient mountains to the east that are called the Acadian Mountains. These were Himalaya-style mountains in what is currently Connecticut, Massachusetts, and adjacent portions of Europe as well, all the way up to Great Britain, Scotland. Well, they're different age. In our part of the world, they were large mountains that were draining primarily to the west into a great continental shallow sea that was covering most of the North American continent. The shoreline is right in around the Schoharie region. So occasionally you'll find sediments that are clearly marine. Just above them you might find sediments that are terrestrial. We're dealing with this deltaic kind of environment. With lots and lots of sediment.
Okay, so we can get this picture of these this forest growing pretty close to the coast at that time. And with the different sea levels, rise and fall, the sea, the margin between the land and the sea would be migrating back and forwards away from these mountains.
Yes, depending on how close you are to the source of terrestrial sediments, terrestrial rivers bringing sediment down. There's always the possibility of storms that are bringing, like hurricanes, bringing in material from the marine realm. And we see nice horizons that strongly suggest that there's a marine influence of that type, but not at this particular, not representing this particular event. The sandstone that we see is all very clearly terrestrial in origin.
Oh, okay. So it was a flood from river system rather than from the sea.
A river or deltaic system, but with source coming from the upland areas. Rather than from the ocean itself.
How did the climate differ at this time? And where was this forest in terms of latitude? Because the continent shifted about. Was it still in the same position, relatively?
North America and Europe were connected as part of an ancient continent called the Old Red. That's the term I like to use for it. Russia is another. Perhaps more modern term one uses to apply to it. In the Middle Devonian, it was approximately 30 degrees south latitude, and tropical.
So it's on the other side of the equator.
Tropical to semi-tropical in environment. There's been some debate about how tropical. And of course, that depends on a lot of definitions. That actually brings up some interesting things we've been thinking about in terms of understanding these ecosystems. Even though the Devonian is impossibly long ago in terms of comparing it with modern relatives, which we may or may not have, one can still ask ecological questions about how an ecosystem becomes established and how plants actually occupy and form that ecosystem, since they're the major players, the major structural components of an ecosystem. They're where everything else lives in and around them. They dominate those environments. So we've been very interested in actually comparing modern types of plants, even though they're not closely related, with the ancient kinds of plants to get a sense of what the boundaries are in terms of how we can interpret these forests. So the best analogies we've come up with so far for Eosporomatopterus are something like a palm, which is a modern angiosperm, monocot angiosperm, not even closely related, and a seed plant, nonetheless. But you can imagine a plant with a large main stem, main trunk, with often a very bulbous base, with very similar kinds of roots anchoring it into the soil, with a single apex growing a large system of fronds, we call them, these branch systems that actually do the photosynthesis and reproduction in these forms. Eosporomatopterus is almost certainly very much like that. Another analogy we've been looking at is modern tree ferns. If you go to the Big Island of Hawaii, very large tree ferns that have essentially the same kind of morphology. Interestingly enough, with the tree ferns, and probably true of the Devonian forms as well, is that our concept of tree needs to be modified to some degree in terms of what we think of trees ought to be based upon our modern forms. If you look at the arborescent, the tree form, tree ferns in Hawaii, many of them are toppled on a regular basis. Do they care? No. They run along the ground as if they're a regular fern and then go right back up again. And we suspect that perhaps that's a possibility, in fact, a very strong possibility for many of the kinds of plants that we're observing here, that they're not necessarily in place all the time at the same place and are not necessarily all that traumatized, if you will, by falling. The other analogies people often draw about early forests is you tend to think of modern conifer forests, because conifers are relatively primitive compared to flowering plants. One tends to get a sense that a primeval forest would be something like the rainforests of the temperate rainforests of North America, dominated by spruces and pines and so forth. A very dark and a very different kind of environment, probably to what we have at Gilboa. What we see with Gilboa is we have trees that don't have a lot of branches, They're not capable, they don't have leaves, they're not capable of producing a deep shade as you would see in those kinds of environments. And so we can imagine a forest that's actually open with lots of cohorts, perhaps, of trees of roughly the same age. Lots of disturbance in this site, lots of sunlight compared to modern forests, and actually a reasonably disturbed environment in which every century or so, or perhaps less, you see total destruction of those forests and then replacement of those forests, one after the next.
So modern forests, the trees grow tall for competition with the light. If there's not much of a canopy in these forests, why would they necessarily have to grow tall? Why couldn't they all grow horizontally?
I'd say for well over 100 years, the argument has been that why do you have trees is that it's a competition for dominance in the canopy. And I would guess that that's probably correct. You have certain advantages if you can actually overtop your neighbors. The overtopping in the lower Devonian may well have been only a few inches high if the trees in that forest are of that scale. By the middle Devonian, it's very clear the trees have evolved the capacity to be tall enough to be considered modern scale trees. And I think that competition was actually underway, although one could argue that they weren't as... The ecosystem itself wasn't as well established, and the niches that we normally talk about in terms of modern forests aren't anywhere near as well developed as they are now. But I would imagine that the competition was the driving force, even if efficiency in occupying the space and light wasn't as high.
So we said that the forest was 20 degrees south of the equator. Do you get any different types of forests or different compositions as you migrate away from the equator?
The further away you go from the equator, the colder it gets on average, and also with elevation, same basic pattern. Those create marked changes in, and of course,
with the amount of light that comes down as well.
And of course, the amount of light. If you get very, very far north into the conifer forests, you often see that much of light reception is actually lateral. It's coming sideways as opposed to from down on top. And the trees actually reflect that. Most conifer trees are little poles because they're not really trying to occupy space and be illuminated from above. The game is being illuminated from the side, in part. There's also the problem with lots and lots of snow, and so you have to have a structure that's capable of withstanding the load.
Do we see any of this in the Devonian, any of the changes with latitude, or do we not have enough of a well-preserved fossil record to be able to tell?
The evidence is primarily dominated by terrestrial tropical kinds of environments, partly as a result of the way fossils are made and preserved, partly because those are the continental blocks that are currently occupied by paleobotanists. If you really wanted to study boreal systems, you'd have to go into pretty unusual places like Siberia and hope that you could find exposure, or perhaps South Africa or South America would be places to have more opportunities. But North America, Europe, China are very important, and Australia, very important portions show Devonian evidence. They're all tropical.
Okay, so do we get any animals preserved in these forests, or is it just the plants?
In a nearby site, the Blenheim Gilboa site, there was a spectacular discovery and description of early arthropods, including Trigona tarbids, which are a spider-like animal of spider size, although some of them pretty good size, up to a couple inches, I guess. There were quite a few evidence of millipedes and centipede-like animals, an early spinneret indicating a modern, or at least belonging to the modern spiders, and a bunch of other really odd things, clearly indicating that as far as terrestrial animals go, the arthropods are the first and still probably the most important second player in terrestrial ecosystems besides besides plants. The arthropods really rule all ecosystems anyway, and they sort of clearly got an early start at it. The oldest tetrapods, the oldest vertebrate kinds of animals, are just a little bit later in time from Gilboa, from the upper Devonian of Pennsylvania and other and related sites, also Europe, Greenland. And so there's nothing to suggest that they have evolved yet in the Gilboa region, but I wouldn't put it past them. The earliest records of these things are always very, very iffy, because it depends on chance finding that. We're not that far away, and I wonder if we don't have clear evidence of whether there isn't evidence of terrestrial forms. At a nearby site, we're studying another forest site besides the Gilboa site. We've actually found the State Museum Group, along with Richard Cloutier, who's in Quebec, have discovered a very large assemblage of fishes that are actually in a forest.
In a forest.
In a forest. It brings up lots of questions, like, how is that supposed to happen? How does that actually take place? What is the event that actually causes this, an assemblage of marine fishes in a terrestrial forest? So we have a lot of explaining to do, but there's lots of evidence in the Devonian of vertebrates that are both marine as well as intertidal and estuarian kinds of animals that are very close to being at the point of being very, very, they're right at the boundary between the terrestrial and the semi-terrestrial environments.
So normally when we think of the first animals on land, just in the back of my mind, I've got a picture of this fish just crawling up onto the land. So the evidence from Gilboa is that arthropods were already there first, and the kind of environments that these fish, when they did crawl out of the ocean, would be they're crawling out into this forest inhabited by thousands of arthropods, this bug forest.
It's a bug forest. Yeah, in fact, that may be a major reason to come out there.
Yeah, if they're hungry.
And you often have this view of an early tetrapod crawling out on the beach from the marine environment, which is almost, I would guess, nearly preposterous an idea. I'd say the best environments to look for for the origin of tetrapods would be in backwater swamp kinds of environments that are partly terrestrial, partly marine already, brackish water kinds of environments, environments that shift daily on a cycle of water coming in and coming out.
Is that kind of like the mangroves? Is that the next example?
Mangroves, estuarian swamps, those kinds of environments is where you would expect animals to actually be able to function in those environments to begin with, and then to actually exploit the edges, both in terms of the marine as well as the terrestrial. Well, interestingly enough, when you look at early tetrapods, and again, I'm a paleobotanist, so what do I know? But when you look at early tetrapods, they're nearly all carnivorous animals. So where are they getting the source of their energy? Probably, even when they're the earliest of the terrestrial forms are still getting most of their energetic needs as an ecosystem from the aquatic realm or the near marine or brackish water realm, as opposed to terrestrial source. Although arthropods are a choice, are possible as well.
So if we take it back to Gilboa itself, the locality, is there any, what's the potential for uncovering further material? You say that the material that you got was exposed during the quarry. Would it continue further?
The quarry was refilled by the city of New York as part of their work, so it will not be available for another lifetime or so.
But is the forest still there?
The forest
still beyond the quarry?
It's certainly there. It goes back into the hillside. You find evidence of not just one forest horizon, but several in the Gilboa region. And as you look at outcrops, you can find examples of Eospermatopters cropping out at these other sites. I think Eospermatopters, per se, was one of the weeds of the Middle Devonian, if not the weed. It was probably everywhere in the Catskill Delta complex and in Europe. And so it's likely we found a lot of different places. what makes Gilboa so unique was the fact that the forest was preserved in such a manner that its structure was preserved. Again, another analogy I like to draw is, again, with dinosaurs. Everybody likes dinosaurs, so everybody knows about them. But if you think about dinosaur evidence, you can actually study the body fossils of dinosaurs, the bones, or you can study their footprints. That turned out to be a major thing a few years back, where one could actually understand something about how dinosaurs moved and lived and did all those things by studying evidence of them living as footprint evidence, as opposed to death assemblage information that was the bones. Same thing, I think, is going on here with these forests. The Gilboa was one of now two sites that we have where we actually have the living footprints of that forest, its structure and its forms. So not dinosaurs, they're not running around, they're being plants as opposed to animals, but they're showing us clear evidence of what it was like to grow in those environments, how that ecosystem was assembled. I think about forest footprints in much the same way as you might think about dinosaur footprints.
In the introduction, we stated that the origin of forests was a world-changing event. So what was the actual global impact of forests?
There's several ways I could answer that question, so let me think about this for a second. Today we're terribly interested in the effect of deforestation, the idea of that the impact that we humans are having on the global environment may be in part related to the destruction of forests, destruction of trees, and denuding those environments of a cover that would be, the forest system. And of course, we're interested in the effect that might have in the levels of CO2, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and global temperatures, among many other factors that play into this. When you talk about the origin of terrestrial tree-sized ecosystems in the Middle Devonian, the term that's been applied for that is called afforestation as opposed to deforestation. And one is interested in afforestation perhaps as a mirror for the kinds of effects and interactions that are important that actually might tell us something about deforestation. Although we're talking about greatly removed kinds of plants and times, it's still very, very interesting to know how those kinds of things are related. Associated with the origin of trees, like Eospermatopterus and the other tree form things at Gilboa, at about that particular time, if you look at carbon dioxide levels as measured in a couple ways from the sediments, you see a dramatic drop in the levels of CO2 in the atmosphere, leading to a major extinction event and glaciation by the end of the Devonian period. So in a sense, they're mirror images of the problems are mirror images. The afforestation, deforestation problems are kind of mirror images. So we're very interested in how that might play out. There's a current hypothesis, it's the Algeo-Scheckler hypothesis, that suggests that that with the origin of terrestrial ecosystems and forests of modern scale, you see a major shift in the way in which carbon is being deposited and recycled on the Earth on a global scale. And that this had not only effects in the terrestrial ecosystem, but also had some profound effects in the marine realm. And you can imagine all the different kinds of effects these might have been, climate as well as nutrients, resources, and the like. In addition, there's been some very interesting work by a group of Canadian geologists who suggested that with the origin of forests, you may see a dramatic change, permanent and dramatic change in the way in which river systems function in the terrestrial environment. Before that, we see a very different kind of sedimentary pattern than, say, by the time you're in the end of the Devonian, where you see what this is essentially a modern way in which sediment and materials and nutrients are actually recycled in those environments as well. So I think the bottom line is it appears that forests were very, very important. The difficulty and the interests as far as studying them has to do with, although one could argue that these are important effects, it's just interesting to study directly through time what those effects might have been and how they might have been related to each other, both temporally and also in terms of connecting one causal factor with another, say, result.
So it's pretty surprising the actual influence forest has on the planet and how much we've learned from this locality at Bilboa. So is it not a shame that the locality isn't there to be enjoyed by everyone? Why is it that they've covered it back over instead of opening it to the public?
It's kind of like archaeology, I would think. On occasion, you will excavate a site. I come from New Mexico, so you can think of the great Chaco and houses in Chaco Canyon or something like that. You have the opportunity, perhaps once in a lifetime, to excavate a great house like that. And the choice is what to do with it. On the one hand, you can make it into a public museum, but then you have to worry about maintaining it. You also have to worry about whether or not, by natural processes, it will actually disintegrate. How are you going to handle that? The other solution, the common solution, is to actually cover it back up again, preserve it that way. It wasn't a choice for me to make or for us to make as paleontologists. The site sits behind the security fences for the City of New York water supply, which is an important issue, increasingly so. But it's being very well, it was very well handled, I think, by them. They covered it over with a nice material to actually preserve the site, to exclude oxygen from the site. So I think it's actually in pretty good hands, it's available for study sometime in the future.
Have there been any problems with private or amateur collectors? I mean, after hearing all of this, I wouldn't mind an Eospermatopterus onion sat in my front room.
The locals have always been interested, and they will, in fact, turn up stumps every so often, and they know what they are, and they're very proud of them. I think that's fine. They have a wonderful museum at Gilboa that displays some of these things. And an interesting Gilboa Historical Society that like to learn about these things. And I think that's all for the good. I have noticed a few specimens showing up on eBay, which I think is, and they're usually fragmentary pieces. We don't suffer from the same kind of syndrome that you see with other kinds of showy fossils like
trilobites
or whatever. It's a concern. It doesn't get out of hand. Fortunately, I don't think these people are going to have access to material that will damage the importance of the site itself, in part because it's covered.
So an amazing story there, courtesy of Professor Stein.
Yeah, I find it amazing that these forests were both created and exhumed by floods just 400 million years apart.
And the whole town was completely submerged, really interesting.
One thing to note is that on our website we have the supplementary material that accompanies this episode, with pictures of the village before it was flooded, as well as ones from the 2010 excavation.
And we've got some videos there as well.
Yeah, we got that thanks to Dr. Chris Berry of Cardiff University, who was part of the research team and took the video while he was actually at the excavation.
It gives us some insight into the real scale of the operation. Workmen there washing down all the rocks and doing a meticulous job of mapping the area.
I think it's amazing that they ran out of cones. There were actually that many tree stumps.
As always, you can discuss the episode on our forum, links to which can be found on the website.
Yeah, just follow through on the episodes, or if you'd like to see or talk more about the trees, there's the relevant sections of our forum if you follow through, from taxa and then plants. So thanks, Joe. I'll see you next time.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with John Tennant and Joe Keating. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society. Music was supplied by The Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.